Hello and welcome to The Catbird Speaks, the podcast for BP Southside, your local site covering the White Sox for Baseball Prospectus. I am your co-editor-in-chief, Nick Schaefer, and I am joined tonight by Dr. 100 himself, Mark Permiano in Las Vegas, Nevada. How you doing, Mark?
Not too bad. It's been nice. I actually got to watch last night and today's game. It's the first time all season I've gotten to watch consecutive games.
Same, yeah. Same here. The timing's been good, and I've been fortunate in my personal schedule to be able to do that. One of those games was more fun than the other.
Yeah, just a little bit.
But
I mean, it's not like today's game wasn't bad. Like, a 1-0 loss is just kind of like, I mean, it's not great, but it beats the hell out of being on the other end of, like, a drubbing.
It could have been so much worse, and it has been so much worse. So,
yeah.
We last recorded on April 4th. The White Sox have won either one or two games since then. I'd have to check that Rays game. We've had multiple snowouts over that time span. There were a couple of like heartbreaking, very close losses. There was this long stretch, and it kind of persisted into today, of what I perceive to be mostly fluky runners in scoring position, runner in third less than two out sort of scenarios that just didn't work out. There was a lot of that, and some of that decided a few games. Then there was just some horrible, horrible, horrible pitching. I mean, Miguel Gonzalez looked very injured for several starts, and then it turned out he was injured. Giolito's velocity is back to, he basically looks like 2016 Giolito, which is really not a good situation. Lopez keeps doing well, I suppose.
Yeah.
But that brought us up to today. Carson Fulmer had a good outing. Oh, sorry, no, that was last night. That was not today.
But Volstead actually pitched very well today.
Yeah, and that was, I guess that's where you're part of what you were talking about, where this, it was a 1-0 loss, but really,
yeah, given not quite a moral victory, but I guess the closest you can get to that, where it's you're starting a guy who. Chris Konka had that wonderful tweet earlier where Volstead's last two wins, one was last year against the Astros with the White Sox, and before that it was 2012. And so when you're throwing out a guy that, yeah, has not won another game since, God, 6 years ago, that's insane that you only lose 1-0.
You know, it's the last time the White Sox had a winning season, so maybe it's a sign. They're going to be more than 10 games above 500 the rest of the year.
What aging third baseman do we trade for?
David Freese? Does that fit the mold?
I guess. That's a disappointing option.
Well, that's the old brand, right?
Yeah.
I will say, Volstead and Santiago have really bailed out the rotation, and that's kind of it's sort of an object lesson in why you want to have a lot of these guys stashed in AAA or you invite them to spring training, because as we've seen. Even someone like Miguel Gonzalez, who you would have thought is one of the more reliable options coming into this year, at least he's proven he could do it in the past. He's got thin margins, and he's had this will be his second injury in less than a calendar year. Second injury where he tried to pitch through it and gave up like, you know, 6+ runs before he got into the third inning for like 3 starts before anybody was like, hey, how's your shoulder feeling? So that's played out twice now for the White Sox in the last year. I shudder to think of what might have been if Santiago and Volstead weren't able to like stop the bleeding a little bit. So that's been pleasant. I will say though, you mentioned trading for garbage third baseman as is tradition.
Hey, Euclid was not garbage for us.
No. I don't remember how well he played defensively, but he got on base.
he hit pretty dang well. I mean, he was slightly above average, OPS plus of 108, which was better than anything else they got.
It was
like the previous 2 or 3 years, because hell, who else played third for us that year? Orlando Hudson, Martin.
Brent Morrell?
Yes, Brent Morrell, the Mushroom Man.
Dude, Morrells are, they're so good.
Yeah, Hudson, Morrell, a little bit of Eduardo Escobar. Oh, man.
Eduardo Escobar is actually decent.
He is. But and then he wasn't back then.
No,
back
and then
terrible. And it was just like, oh, we traded him for Liriano? Like, done. Great. Awesome.
Oh, really? I even at the time, was very dubious because Escobar looked like someone who... I mean, at the time, he was like a plus glove at short, which was something. And for White Sox position players at the time internally, I was like, well, hey, that's better than a lot of the other stuff they've been bringing through.
Yeah, but with him at least, it was one of those where, like, yeah, he looked really great defensively, but his bat was completely anemic. And we already had Alice Ramirez, where it was just like, all right, there's not really going to be a window for you anytime soon other than just defensive caddy.
Well, ironically, they wound up using Ray Almedo and, like, Angel Sanchez in that role coming down the stretch. And Escobar's glove alone probably would have helped them more than Liriano did in hindsight, just in 2012. Yeah.
I remember exactly where I was when I found out about that trade. I was at a basement party in Calgary.
Oh, what?
Yeah, it was a weird day.
It was just, you just spent one day in Calgary?
Oh, no, I was up there for a few days, but...
Why were you, what?
The ex.
Oh.
That was when I went to meet her family.
Oh, okay. And then her family had a basement party?
Yeah, her younger siblings. So I was drinking with, like... What in Canada were people that could drink? What were in America were not people who could drink. And one of them was like, hey, Francisco Liriano just got traded. I'm like, why do you guys care? You live in Calgary.
Yeah, he's not on the Flames. But, you know, I'm glad that they hid in the basement because otherwise they might have been, you know, cooked to death in the Calgary sun.
It's a scorcher up there. It was a whole 22 degrees.
I don't remember where I was. Didn't stand out. I can guarantee I wasn't in Calgary at the time.
I'm generally very good at remembering where I was for trade deadline deals because the trade deadline is my mom's birthday.
So it always
like helps that it sticks. Like I know I was in a different basement, not at a party, when they traded Esteban Loaiza for Jose Contreras. I was in my best friend's basement, and we were playing MVP 2004.
Oh, nice. I do remember where I was when, I think it was when they tried to trade for Jake Peavy the first time, and he declined the trade.
Yep.
And that I was in a basement at the time.
See? Basements make trades happen.
And it wasn't my mother's basement either.
The Kevin Youkilis trade, I was drinking in a Plainfield bar with a commenter from Southside Sox who lived, I think, in Lockport, and was just like, yeah, you know, let's go watch a game together. I'll buy. And I was like, okay. And so we're sitting there watching the Sox beat Zach Greinke pitching for the Brewers. And sure enough, the Yuke trade went through. And this was like days after Gordon Beckham's cryptic Yolk tweet.
Back when, like, not nearly as many people were on Twitter. So there have been some positive developments. I mean, Yolmer Sanchez looks like this is the new normal, right? I mean, maybe not this good, but he has definitely... It looks like last year was for real rather than being sort of a high watermark, I guess, which is pleasant. I mean, he's certainly... everyday third baseman isn't the ideal role for him, I don't think. I think he's certainly a better fit at second generally or moving around, but he is hardly a problem there. I mean, he's better than what a whole lot of teams are running out there at third.
Exactly. He's not going to be someone you build your team around, but if he can be like a, I don't know, like a Walmart version of Ben Zobrist, that's pretty damn useful.
Yeah, and he's, just I think he's just becoming ARB eligible. Was this his first year of ARB, I think?
He'll be ARB eligible next season.
Got it. Well, it's, I mean, he's making 2.35 this year. Is he doing, he might be a 4 year of ARB guy.
I think so.
Okay. But that's been a positive development, if we're keeping it positive.
He's got 2.134 years of service time right now per Baseball Reference.
You know what? The service time counting stuff is so Byzantine and bizarre to me. I know it should be very simple, but it's just not. So.
Yeah, it's unnecessarily difficult.
It's like how I remember being in calculus class, and we'd gotten to the end of the year, and our teacher was like, all right, I'm going to do like two lessons on stuff with the z-axis included. I'm not grading you on this. This is just if you're interested, because we're done with the curriculum. And some people can think in three dimensions and some people just straight up can't, and it's fine. Like, don't worry about it. So that's how I am with service time, I feel like.
I still am baffled that for my animal science degree, I had to take business calculus.
Huh.
And I am very much not one of the people that can think like calculus at all. So I sat there just being like, oh no,
Business
paying a tutor
calculus
named Aaron Hill, who I selected solely because his name was Aaron Hill. And I was like, hey, play baseball for the Blue Jays. And man, I should have gotten a better tutor because he was not great.
Whoa, calling out business calc tutors is not on this widely listened to business calc tutor podcast is pretty messed up, man. We'll have to go back and edit that out.
Yeah, poor Aaron.
If I edit the name out, people will just have to think it's any number of Blue Jays second baseman from the last decade. So take that, Ryan Goins.
Yeah, Kendall Hudson.
Oh, dog. So I'd had been saying, you know, keep. That's not you, but people were understandably starting to wring their hands a whole lot about Yoan Moncada. Certainly to start the year, the batting average was still low, striking out like crazy. He's still striking out. I think that's kind of always going to be part of his game.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, also to the extent that it's a huge part of pretty much everyone's game at this point, because it's 2018 and it's, you know, not the 50s anymore. Pitchers
he's
strike
a very
dudes
good
out.
Poster boy for it, where it's just like, wow. That was eloquent.
Well, and you'd been seeing, I think that sometimes, all right, so with exit velocity and launch angle, I think it's cool. I'm sure the more we tinker with it, we can start figuring out what to do with it as casual fans or week to week or whatever it may be. It always feels a little bit post-hoc to me, if that makes sense. Like it's hard to know whether it's predictive. Like I think I mentioned this before, but apparently forever, like the Mets were early on exit velocity, and Eric Campbell had amazing exit velocity, but he always hit it directly into the dirt, so he still was horrible. But they were like, oh, but this exit velocity, I'm sure he'll come around. So it's not perfect. And I remember Ethan showing us years ago the sort of bimodal arc of the value of launch angle, right? And that makes sense based on the positioning of fielders. Like at a certain point, launch angle goes up, it gets better and better, and then there's a range where it gets worse, and then it gets better, and then it gets worse again as it becomes pop-up. So just to say, oh, look at his average launch angle or look at his average exit velocity, it's not perfect. But I will say that Moncada was, I think, leading the league in hard-hit balls when he was getting his bat on it. And for a while, I think he was just getting unlucky. Obviously, the contact part is going to be what holds him back. But, you know, we've really started to see the power even over the last couple of weeks. Right now, he's up to 244, 352, 500. And to me, the issue I'm more interested to keep an eye on moving forward is the platoon split. I don't know how you feel.
I mean, he is one where I saw your one tweet yesterday with the galaxy brain, and he needs to stop switch hitting.
I mean, that was mostly a joke.
Well, I know, but it did stick. It is something I laughed about a pretty good amount because, yeah, his platoon split against lefties is considerably worse. Like, if you just look at how he's hit against right-handers for his career, you're just like, yeah, that's good. 839 OPS. Like, yeah, I can live with that out of a second baseman for sure. And then you just look at what he's doing against left-handers, and it's 574.
Mm-hmm. And it's it was even more extreme coming into today. It'll update. I haven't seen the update yet. Coming into today, he had an OPS over 1,000 against right-handed pitchers and an OPS of 367 against lefties. Obviously, the whole, you know, all of his at-bats together are too small a sample to draw any conclusions from. That sample I'm quoting to you is 23 PAs against lefties. So, you know, that's nothing. I think Paul Goldschmidt was hitting like 100 after 20 at-bats this year. I think Paul Goldschmidt's pretty good. So, you know, keep that in mind. It could very well just – I was thinking about this further, and it could very well just be in a sort of a microcosm of Moncada as a whole, right, where he's got so much raw talent and his eye is so good that it's purely a function of reps. And he faces more right-handed pitchers, and he's gotten a lot more reps from the left side. Obviously, very few hitters are the same. Even switch hitters are the same from both sides of the plate, so there's probably a difference there already. But I think just as time goes on and he sees more from the left side at the major league level, that gap will close.
Yeah, most likely.
Or, you know, he could just try hitting lefty against everyone.
Yeah.
It's been done before.
Going back to the launch angle thing real quick. It kind of amazes me how hard everyone's trying to act like this is like a brand new idea and that, oh, yeah, well, look at this. And it's like, well, yeah, we're finally actually having it measured with every hitter. But there was the one tweet last night that posted evidence from like an 1800s newspaper that said something to the effect of like 23 degrees is the ideal launch angle that you should be hitting a baseball at for maximum results.
And oh, really?
Yeah. And it's just one of those things where it's, yeah, anyone that's taken a physics class where you've, like, learned parabolic arches, just, yeah. you should be able to just, obviously, if you went up to just any random person that had, you know, done high school physics and you're like, hey, what should be, like, the ideal angle someone hits a baseball at? They're probably just going to go, what's wrong with you? Why are you asking me? But they could at least give you an idea of just like, yeah, I can't give you the number, but I could like mime the swing it should be.
Yeah, I mean, but again, they need to work together in tandem because, you know, I could have a perfect launch angle, but if I hit it, you know, 350 feet to dead center, that center fielder doesn't budge.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely not a thing you can just look at alone because you'll see – it annoys me so much when you see just like, wow, he hit that 116 miles per hour exit velocity. It's like, yeah, but where?
Foul.
Like, yeah, it doesn't matter.
I mean, and
itself is meaningless.
I think over time, it's like, in a lot of ways, it's kind of like fastball velocity where...
Exactly, yeah. You can throw 104 miles an hour, but if you can't locate it, what's the point?
Right, but at the same time, if you look at the leaderboards for fastball velocity over the course of like a year or two or three, most of the guys at the top, certainly the people who get pitch enough to qualify for the ERA title, most of them are going to be really good because the best guys have velocity and command rather than someone with command who's just trying to make up for that shortcoming. But you do get, you know, Mike McDougal threw crazy hard. Everybody remember Mike McDougal?
I do, but wasn't that... I don't think anyone outside of AL Central fans do.
Who are, well, actually, I mean, I was going to say Nick Pivetta was like the joke of, I think, I'm trying to remember who, I think it was one of the BP Mets guys said, you know, he's the test for how badly can you pitch while throwing triple digits. Obviously, he's had a really good start to the year, so perhaps we need a new example for that. But late career Jason Mott. Scott Linebrink threw hard relatively for the time at the end there.
David Aardsma.
I will not let you badmouth David Aardsma for a second.
I'm not badmouthing him. I'm just saying.
Well, we're talking about dudes who threw a million miles an hour and weren't good, so how dare you, sir?
Joba.
I think like 4 or 5 years ago, I just tweeted like, hey, you guys remember that time David Aardsma came in with the bases loaded, none out, and struck out five guys in a row? And David Ardsma responded. He was like, "I do. It was great. It was so good." I think he's also still like alphabetically first.
Probably. I mean, it's going to be pretty hard to top AARD.
Well, AAP. I don't know if that's coming up. Just get triple A at the beginning of your name. I don't even know what language that would have to come from. But yeah, totally. And well, Billy Koch was like that towards the end too.
Before he wound up getting the skin worms.
Yeah, I don't want to think about that because if anyone can talk themselves into to that disease too, it'll be me. So I'm just going to not overthink it. Do you feel any differently about Carson Fulmer than you did before the season started?
No.
Yeah.
No. I want to, especially with we've always joked about the Jim Callis quote where it's like he's who you'd want your daughter to marry.
Right.
But the more we hear about what he's like in the clubhouse through our unnamed source, the more I want to just love Carson Fulmer because it's just like, wow, you are just an incredibly likable person.
Yeah, I mean, he's got his baseball reference page. He's got like a big goofy smile. He doesn't blame his defense. He doesn't, you know, it's always just I got to work harder and do better and all that stuff. And it is interesting. I mean, the innings counts are tiny at this point. In the majors in 16, 17, and 18, he's thrown 11, 23, and 18 innings now, respectively. That's not a whole lot. But
no, he is also only 24 still. But
his home run, walk, and strikeout rates are like identical over those three tiny samples at different times of year, which is kind of funny. And it's very bad. But yeah.
It's kind of impressive that it hasn't gone up or down at all.
1.5 homers per nine. All three years.
And then walks per nine, 5.4, 5.5. Strikeouts per nine, 7.7, 7.3, 7.5.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost admirable consistency.
Well, look.
If you want better results.
Look, the strikeout to walk has gone from 1.43 to 1.46 to 1.5. If these trends continue, give him another 20 years, he'll be above two.
Yeah, he'll be Chris Sale.
Well... Sounds like another 100 years at that rate.
Strikeouts going up, Nick.
I think Sale's gotten better. I don't know. I have to check.
Probably.
Oh, no. His caper K to walk last year was better than this year.
Oh, White Sox won the trade.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, Fulmer, it's frustrating because some of the – so he got spotted as a 7-0 lead or five. He got spotted a huge lead against the Mariners, and that lineup's been struggling. I mean, Kyle Seager isn't hitting anything, and I'm pretty sure Kyle Seager will hit something eventually. He's pretty good at that. And so obviously pitching with a lead, he managed to, you know, keep the walks in. It was a good start. He did fine. But some of his better pitches were he'd miss his target by like a lot. He'd be aiming for the inside corner. He'd miss, hit the outside corner, and there, you know, it worked out because there were a few where it's, you know, if he's throwing 94 and it's moving and it hits the black, and it hits the wrong black, like it doesn't matter all that much. But that's not on purpose, and that's not really sustainable. I mean, it is in the sense that his stuff is really good and he's going to get away with mistakes, but he makes too many.
It's one of those things where. You start to worry, all right, well, the backup plan has always been if he doesn't make it as a starter, you can at least just throw him in the bullpen. But with how he's been pitching, it doesn't really strike me as that would really fix the issue.
No, I was thinking about that too. And maybe it's anecdotal. I kind of want to check now. But he's, in terms of times through the order, he's either... He's a reliever. You'd have to accept that he's going to come in and just might be a gas can because his command is so fickle. Looking at this now, just going by inning, and again, small samples, but first inning, and maybe this is the answer. First inning, he has an ERA of one. Strikeout to walk ratio of 1. Second inning, the OPS allowed is over 1,000. A good chunk of that's probably that one start against the Twins. But if he's not somebody you can, if he's someone who needs like 40 pitches to get a feel for his stuff that day, then you can't, that's not a reliever.
No.
Obviously, it's a different approach if he's starting a game trying to go six than just blowing it out. But like, and maybe trying to just throw 20 pitches as hard as he can, he'll go up to, you know, 98 instead of 95. But it's I wouldn't feel very comfortable bringing him into any high leverage situation as it stands now.
It's just too dangerous.
But I mean, if he gets, how much more command do you think he needs to be a viable fourth starter? Like, is it half a grade? Is that it with his stuff?
Realistically, yeah, if he could pull that off. But that's also, you could say that about so many players that just never quite pulled it off.
Yeah, I mean,
like, you just improved that one little thing, you'd be the best. You would be workable.
Well, this is his time to muddle through. It's cool to see that his stuff, if it's even doing close to what he wants it to do, is tricky, can be tricky to square up. At the risk of sounding like Don Cooper, I mean, maybe it's just a matter of, hey, dude, aim for the heart of the plate and get your first strike. Your pitch moves enough that if you aim right down the middle, maybe it'll stay in the zone. Still, they really needed that from him, the way the rotation had been going. He and Volstead and Santiago definitely bailed them out. Ronaldo Lopez. Thoughts?
I mean, the one bright spot in the rotation currently.
Mm-hmm.
One of three bright spots in the entire pitching staff. And that's, I guess, including Joachim Soria, who it's like, I'm kind of stretching the idea of a bright spot.
Yeah, I mean, he's Joachim Soria is a competent, continues to be an above-average reliever, as he has been for 8 years or so.
Yeah, he's doing what he's supposed to be.
Yep.
Or it's like, yep, you're doing more good than bad, and you exist. Keep it up.
Bruce Rondon's been like Jekyll and Hyde, but I'm interested. Nate Jones is actually doing his thing, even though it mentally hasn't felt like that, just because we haven't really seen him much. But
that, and every time he pitches, it just really hasn't mattered.
Right, but then I go look, and it's like, oh yeah, ERA of under 2, 10 strikeouts,
and
7 innings
today. He looked like vintage Nate Jones, which was nice.
Yeah, I mean, it's been really rough, and I wrote about this before the season started, where I was like, if things are going to go well, right, if this team's going to maybe hang around 500 for a couple months, it was going to be because the rotation did all right. Because I wrote about this before, there was disaster potential here, and we're seeing it. I mean,
yeah,
Giolito, I've seen people sort of using Giolito as a lesson to say, aha, this is why spring training narratives are silly. And he's a bad example to prove that otherwise very true point. Because in spring training, Giolito was measurably pitching differently. Giolito was 91 to 95 in spring training. And he was throwing his curve a lot, and the curve looked good, and he was throwing it for strikes. I think he's kind of abandoned his curve again. He's doing his, like, falling behind with his fastball and then trying to muddle through with his okay changeup and his less than okay slider. If he can't get ahead of anybody at all, he can't really ever throw the curve confidently. And his velocity's back down to like 89, 91. And it's, I mean, they've had unseasonably cold weather. It's been a weird start to the season, like with the snowouts and the cold, and gosh, I mean, freaking Farquhar fighting for his life, and like it's been weird. So part of me wants to just like give him a mulligan, but if the I just can't figure out why his velocity would vanish as soon as the game started counting.
I mean, I guess the main hope is that, yeah, it's the weather. I don't know. I mean, it's impossible for any of us to know how much we could actually attribute that to it. But
let's back right. in. I was saying there's a compelling logic to blaming the temperature in the sense that, you know, Giolito's a big guy. It can be hard for bigger pitchers to get loose, and it's easier to loose. You know, anybody who's exercised outdoors could tell you it's easier to get loose in the warm weather than in the cold. But other than that, unless I, you know, looked at video and broke down his mechanics, like I'm kind of at a loss.
Yeah. Well, what I'm kind of just writing this season off as 2007 Gavin Floyd. And I know I keep going back to that well of like Giolito as Floyd. But to me, it is the most fitting one. And if he's going to have a year of just struggling and things looking really rough, this is the year to do it because there is nothing to lose.
Sure.
Like, obviously, I would much prefer to see him take that, turn the corner and take that step. But it's like if he struggles pretty hard this year, he's still young, and this is a year that nothing's going to happen anyway.
Yeah, there's going to be a time where you're going to start need to make decisions on some of these guys. Obviously, obviously he's got this season to do that. And I still like the Floyd comp. I always have. I think that, you know, I've said before, I didn't really think Giolito was still going to be an ace or hope he was going to be a front of the rotation guy. I hoped he'd be a good three or four, and I still think that's, you know, in there. It's and Fulmer too. My hope for him was more fourth or fifth starter rather than any frontline guy because you need those guys, and it's better than. And when I say a number four starter, I don't mean like White Sox James Shields. I mean more like, gosh, I don't know, like Jake Odorizzi a couple years ago in Tampa, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Where it's like a useful, solid guy who's going to take his turn in the rotation. Floyd, though, he didn't have these velocity issues, right?
No, his it was more just pitchability issues. His it was complete lack of command. You look at in 2005 when he got called up to Philly, strikeouts per nine, 5.9, walks per nine, 5.5. The next season, strikeouts per nine, 5.6, walks per nine, 5.3.
Mm.
Then he comes to Chicago, and his strikeout to walk ratio goes from around 1 to 2.5, and that was really when it all starts clicking and things started improving.
Right.
Despite still somehow having an FIP of 607.
Right. I mean, it's only been four starts. I guess it's troubling that the velocity is going and the command isn't there either. It's not like he's taking something off it to put it where he wants. So, you know, that remains to be seen. Obviously, the White Sox are good at this sort of thing. But, you know, in a lot of ways, last year was a mulligan year, too. And
yeah.
It's fine to, you know, I'm fine to be patient. And this is definitely the year to work through it at the major league level. But it's disheartening. And, I mean, it's like, sad to watch. Certainly, the Astros is a tough assignment, but we'll see as things heat up.
Not really fun one to run into at all.
No, especially not when you're not at your best. So yeah, I mean, the rotation is definitely interesting. I was listening to the BP Mets podcast today, actually, and they were talking about where they thought Matt Harvey might wind up after he's inevitably not on the Mets next year. I was wondering if that's the type of dude, if 2019 is still a season where that's the type of dude they might take a flyer on, see if they can claw anything back there. I mean, I'm generally the assumption that if somebody has thoracic outlet syndrome, that the, you know, until proven otherwise, I just assume that they're cooked. But, you know, changes, It could also very well be a change of scenery guy too. That's it doesn't seem like a healthy relationship where the organization's at right now. But Jose Abreu's killing it. Did you want to laugh about Justin Verlander at all?
Most of the time, yeah.
I mean,
what a ridiculous man.
I tweeted about it a lot because that's what Twitter's for. But for those who somehow, if you missed it, Verlander had a no-hitter through going to the fifth. And I think the Astros were already up like 5-0 at that point. And he threw like a really bad breaking ball. And Anderson hit it into left. And he had a single. And he like high-fived Darryl Boston or something. And then Verlander was all mad and red and nude online and fell behind 3-0 on Narvaez. And on the 3-0 pitch, Anderson took off for second. And he walked Narvaez. And Anderson was happy that, hey, you know, they went from no base runners to two base runners. And there was a walk and he stole the base. And Verlander was, he was, and so Anderson, I guess, was, what's the word, expressive about it, was making demonstrative about the fact that he was clearly
happy. I was going to say demonstrative.
Happy.
That's, yeah. That's your word there.
And Verlander got so mad, and he got even more angry when Anderson tried to steal third on him. And I can't even remember if he got picked off or not. It didn't work out.
He got picked off.
Yeah, there we go. And Anderson, and Verlander, like, celebrated that he picked him off, right? Like, he, like, shoved it in his face or something. And then after the game, Verlander talked for like 2 minutes about how, 2 straight minutes or something like that, about how he definitely wasn't mad, but why he was so mad. And how he's like, oh, that's, it's like lame of him to try to steal there. It didn't even count as a steal. It's like, well, he doesn't know you're going to throw a ball, dude.
you're down 5-0. It's not the right way to play baseball.
I mean, do I think trying to steal third down 5 runs is smart? Like, no, I don't. But at the same time, part of Verlander's, like, it's a, hey, Verlander, if you think it was a dumb play that hurt his team's chances of winning, be happy he did it. He's on the other team. Like, yeah, that's fine. And the other thing was, Verlander also was like, oh, well, you know, clearly I wasn't trying to hold him on. Like, I had my high leg kick. I was concentrating on the hitter at home. It's like, so you admit you were conceding the steal.
Yeah.
Is he supposed to just, is he supposed to just let you ignore him and focus on getting his teammate out for what? To be polite? He's trying to beat you.
It's just like the dumb Brian Dozier shit from earlier in the season where, oh, you're down so many runs, you're supposed to stop trying.
Yeah. Yeah, like, and it was the fifth inning.
How many times have we seen teams come back from more than being down more than 5 runs where it's like, oh, Tim Anderson, whose main talent is that he is insanely fast and overall, with a couple exceptions, that and today's base running, makes great decisions on the base paths.
Yeah.
Because his team's down, he's supposed to just go, oh, well, you know, I'll just hang out. I'll stop doing what makes me good.
And again, no, Verlander, yeah, and Verlander put the lie to his own criticism, which is like, well, I'm doing my full windup because I think that makes me better at pitching. So naturally, if you're the opponent, you don't want him to be able to do that. You want to force him to pitch out of the stretch or throw over a couple times because you think that might get a better pitch to hit for your teammate. Like, it doesn't even hold up within his own bizarre ranting. So got some lovely, lovely gentlemen floating around the AL Central. Lots of brain geniuses, which is great. I did enjoy that very much.
He's not in AL Central no more.
Oh, you know what? You're right. I'll always think of him that way. Yeah, like you said, there are teams that have blown 5-run leads. The White Sox, I think, did that like multiple times in one game against Oakland.
Yeah, it happens.
I certainly don't feel right doing a podcast without slamming some sort of fun police nonsense at some point. Since the White Sox are settling in at a cozy 1-win-a-week pace for the time being.
And making me feel really good about not going to a sports book and putting money on the over-under like I planned on.
What was the final? It was what, like 73?
68.5.
Oh.
Them and Detroit both. And my original plan was, all right, well, I'll take the over on us and the under against Detroit and make a tidy sum and put it towards the house fund. But I'm incredibly lazy on my days off and get very opposed to leaving the house if it's not to go grocery shopping or go to the gym.
Right. Well.
And, yeah, that was very effective at keeping me away from the Westgate.
I mean, I still... Man, even with all this in the tank, I'm still tempted to say they're going to finish with more than 68 wins.
I hope so.
I mean, Abisail Garcia did just get hurt today. Saladino's gone. Thompson's here. A lot's happened. Yep. Abisail was looking worse than he ever has before he got hurt. I don't think that was super sustainable, even though it looked bad, as he's prone to do. I just don't see how, like, Moncada is visibly improving. Anderson and Davidson look to have taken real steps forward in their approach, which was clearly the biggest weakness for both of them. Yulmer, like we were talking about, has settled in as what I think is like an average player, maybe a little better than that, depending on his glove and positional adjustments and all that. The pitching's really the limiting factor. I think as the season goes on, if Miguel Gonzalez comes back healthy, we know he can be a perfectly cromulent pitcher. Shields is somehow muddling through. If Fulmer and Giolito improve even just a little bit, Rodon's coming back hopefully in a month. Like, and there's more pitching on the way. Kopech is just dominating Charlotte. And you've got guys like Jordan Stevens. You have relievers coming up who are looking like, I think I was talking to James earlier. He was like, Ryan Burr is a guy who I think could be up in the majors and do well this year. There's stuff there. I just think the team's going to get better as the season goes on rather than worse. But who knows? Maybe they trade Jose Abreu at the deadline and surprise everybody.
Oh, that'd make me so sad.
I know. I just really don't think that's going to happen.
I hope not. It was one of those where I was even just looking today, doing just a little extrapolating to see, like, oh, well, where's he going to be in terms of White Sox career home runs by the end of this year? And realistically, he's going to pass Bill Melton, and that's really cool.
Yeah.
And then if he makes it through the 2019 season with the White Sox and plays around the same level he has been, he'll be fifth in franchise home runs. And that's, I know it doesn't really mean anything, but it also does mean something. And I don't want to see him get traded away.
No, and it's so refreshing to have at least one guy in the lineup who, whenever they're up, you're like, this guy is amazing. At any given time, he could go, you know, hit a home run. It's not like a hope based at bat. And
no, he's someone that you could legitimately drop on any team, and he would be a starter. I mean, yeah, there's a couple National League teams where you could say just like, oh well, he wouldn't be a starter on the Diamondbacks, and it's like, well, yeah, because that league doesn't have the DH because they're stupid as hell.
Yeah, or
like he's a top 10 first baseman. He's probably upper 25% hitter just in general, regardless of position. He's the type of guy you would find a spot for.
Yep. Yeah. I think Anderson is like a good counterexample where he's a hitter where I'm definitely paying attention to his at-bats. Him improving this year would be huge for the organization. I think he's talented, but he's still... he's still uneven, right? Like, at any given at-bat, and obviously any given at-bat, any hitter can look terrible, and Abreu strikes out too and all that stuff, but like Abreu, and frankly, like, Moncada against righties is starting to get there too, where it's like, no, I'm excited that he's coming up. I think he could do some damage, and more than just, I mean, God, far end of the spectrum, it's not like Adam Engel where it's like, oh, geez, dude, like, maybe put in play, like, please, like, I really thought when Trace arrived that would sort of signal the end of watching a whole bunch of angle, but then Avisail immediately went down. So, So much for that.
that dream died very quickly on the vine.
Yeah. Well, if nothing else, the White Sox are tied with the Royals. 5-15. They are not the worst record in baseball. They're still ahead of the Marlins. And the Marlins have two more losses. So I feel like they're still getting, I think they still get a pass in terms of the sense that things are trending in the right direction still, even if the record is horrible, as opposed to like the Reds and Miami, where you're like, I don't know what the plan is here still, and we're at rock bottom.
Especially Cincinnati. I just feel bad for Votto at this point.
Yeah, me too. And it's given how weird the league is right now with just avoiding salary, I don't see how he gets moved. Because if you're the Reds, you can't move him for anything other than like an elite return, and you shouldn't. But at the same time, like, people are going to find it hard to swallow trading elite prospects for. I mean, like, I think Votto's contract is what, like, market? Is that market value ish?
At least what formerly was market value.
If you bake some risk in for age and all that, and he's 34, I think the contract runs through his age 40. Yeah, his age 40 season, at like $25 million a year moving forward. So like, I don't think he'd get that on the open market. So it's just, you know, you saw what the return was for Stanton, and obviously there was a lot of variables there. But Votto could force a trade where, you know, he could. I think he's got his 10-5, right?
He could
even if he didn't have a no trade clause in that contract, which I haven't checked. So yeah, it's a shame to watch him like rot. I guess at the same time, it's cool to watch a player play his whole career in one franchise, which is rare. But it would be nice to see him get to the playoffs again at some point.
Well, he's gone three times. That's more than just about every White Sox player.
yeah, that's true. Interesting. Chris Sale made it as soon as he left. The instant he left, the White Sox do have a doubleheader coming up this weekend. As we've discussed, the pitching staff is stretched pretty thin. What would you do if you were Rick Hahn?
Like, I would just push through it, like. Are you asking if I would call up Kopech?
Kind of. I mean, I guess the question is, you know, they seem to be really anxious not to touch their 40-man roster at all. They seem to and obviously you don't want to lose a player just to try to get through a rough patch. But there's dudes on this 40-man who you could afford to lose. Like, there really are. And I don't know that you call Kopech up necessarily. I think I agree with the plan that once you call him up, you want him to stay up, and you don't want to do that before he's ready. There's no reason to at this stage if you don't, unless you really, really think he's not being challenged at all at Charlotte. But I kind of like the idea that he's comfortable enough where he's at that he can dominate. And he's a competitive guy. He's an extremely competitive guy where he can actually just say, you know what, I'm here to work on my changeup. I'm just going to throw my changeup a ton because I can still get through this regardless, which is kind of nice. But, are you really going to lean on, like, are you really going to burn out some of these arms because you're scared of, I don't know, DFAing Chris Beck? Like, are you worried somebody's going to claim Chris Beck?
Well, I think they're going to just use Chris Beck.
I guess that's, but like that, he's bad enough that that might not like even get, that might not even get you through, you know, that might, all that might do is like he gets you four outs and gives up eight runs or something. Like, he really, I mean, Dan Vogel, was it you who tweeted Dan Vogel about running is my favorite play earlier today?
I think that was Ethan.
Ah, gee, I confuse you two all the time. You're basically the same person.
No, it was Colin.
Same, all three of you, just identical people, in appearance and personality. But
naturally,
Vogelbach's amazing because he really is just like, it's almost like a fictional character, based, you know, if I were using, well, let's have a hypothetical player. We'll call him Stan Mogulmach, and he'll be 5'11", 300 pounds, and he'll hit well, and he's like the worst runner and fielder you've ever seen. And like, what's the value of that?
He feels like an NES baseball character.
Yeah, like the old one.
You're just playing like an old 8-bit video game, and it's just like, yep, and there's the chubby guy who hits well, and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, for those of you who don't, like, Chris Beck came in, and for a minute, with the White Sox were up like 9-2, I think, when Fulmer left, and they were like, all right, well, we'll throw Beck in there, and he'll just soak up these low leverage innings. Gives up a home run to Mitch Haniger. He gives up the first out is like a screaming line drive to right. I can't remember if he lets a couple base runners on, including Vogelbach, falls behind 2-0 to a hitter, and then airmails a wild pitch at like 97 because he throws hard. And Vogelbach gets like confused and jumps off the bag, and they wind up running into a double play and like a pickle, which is fantastic. But for a minute there, you were after Oakland, where you were watching the game. I mean, how much of your brain was like, oh, Beck is going to blow this, isn't he?
Yeah, it like, definitely felt like it.
The 7-run lead in the seventh, I was like, oh, yeah, this isn't safe. So, yeah, I guess they could start him. At a certain point, I also wonder, it's like, hey, look, how many years at Charlotte does Tyler Danish need before we just... I guess it doesn't hurt you to have him in Charlotte, but I don't know. At a certain point, I'd like to see them start filtering through some fresher faces. Maybe they're not at Charlotte yet. I think like Jordan Stevens in the second half might be one of those guys, or Spencer Adams are the types of people I'd like to see. If Jordan Guerrero is already like a Rule 5 candidate, maybe like, I don't know, see what he can do before you cut him loose again. But yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. Also, Eloy hit 2 home runs in his first game back. So
the future's looking brighter every day.
When do you think Eloy's up?
July?
That's a ridiculous answer. It's obviously August.
Well, excuse me.
Yeah, it's kind of funny too, because Cleveland's gotten off to like a not amazing start. So, in other years, maybe there'd be something there. But going out on a positive note, the Yankees continue to humiliate the Twins, and at the end of the day, that's what's important, right?
Oh, definitely. It makes me feel good. I don't think I'll ever hate a baseball team as much as the Twins.
The Royals had taken their place for me for a minute, but I think they flipped back. I think it's gone back to its default setting.
Yeah, moving away from Kansas helped push them back.
Oh, right. Well, also them.
It got rough.
I mean, them turning back into like a 100 loss team doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
Funny how that happens. I don't know, but for some reason, I don't have the same energy about Cleveland. When Cleveland's good, they actually feel like legitimately good to me.
Yeah, it's not frustrating where it's you lose them, they're like, yep, that's just a good team. Whereas losing to the Twins, it was like, all right, well, Santana's pitching, sure. Radke's pitching, sure. Everything else, why can't we not hit you? Why are we losing to an army of
Carlos Silva, Kevin Slowey.
Who was that super annoying hitter they had?
Christian Guzman?
No. Guzman was at least good defensively.
Nick Punto.
Punto, there we go.
Yeah. Well, Punto was like later too, because they had like their alliteration guys. They had like Shannon Stewart and Jock Jones. I guess those guys were actually good.
Yeah, they were good, because those two were legitimate players where you're like, when you had them and Torii Hunter, it was like, wow, that's a really good outfield. It's not like, oh, these are generational players outfield.
But they were actually good.
Outfield.
Yeah, that's true. It always bothered me more when like Chesler Cuthbert beat the White Sox than when like Lorenzo Cain did.
Yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, the Twins for a long time, it was those BS like Metrodome teams where they just hit grounders and they were like doubles and triples and it drove me insane. Versus like those Indians teams that dominated the White Sox in the 90s, it was like, yeah, these are like some of the best offenses of all time. Like, of course they're winning.
Yeah, when you go Lofton, Baerga, Tomey, Bell, you're just like, yep, it's over.
I like how you
it's
went.
It's been four guys. It's already over.
I like how you went to Baerga before like Albert Bell, or not Albert Bell. Sorry, Manny Ramirez, or like Roberto Alomar. Baerga was good. I just thought that was interesting.
He's very good.
Yeah. For some reason, the Cleveland teams that have beaten the White Sox for the division, I was like, yeah, that's fair. That's fair. And like the Twins last year and in 2015, I want to say, also felt supremely lucky. Like yeah. The 83 and 80, whatever, 86, 87 win team that they had last year. Last year, a little less so. But, man, it did not feel deserved. So if the Twins regressed again after last year, it would be a balm to my petty heart. Yeah, I guess moving forward, are there any minor leaguers who aren't the, you know, the big obvious dudes that you're excited about to see moving forward?
Not necessarily. At this point, it feels like if you're trying to just grab one where you're like, oh yeah, this is my under the radar guy, you're just scraping because there's so much attention paid to every level at this point where you can't even just be like, oh, well, Seppi Zavala. And you're just like, no, everyone knows about him.
I mean, and the nice thing is, too, is if Zavala's baseball career doesn't work out, he can always be a character in a Bethesda sci-fi game.
Very true.
That's kind of why I brought up, like, Ryan Burr, for example, because relief prospects aren't super exciting. They don't get that sort of ink, but he's just been, you know, really, really good from a run prevention perspective last year, and he's already in Double-A and he's doing well. I think he got picked up for either IFA money or a very, I think, did they get him for IFA money from Arizona? Anyway, him, and then obviously not like a huge sleeper or anything, but Basabe has been killing it to start the year, and that makes me extremely happy. He's could also, I mean, obviously now like the die is cast and whatever happens is kind of, it's kind of irrelevant to weigh things in the scales against like Chris Sale. But if Basabe turns into a good center fielder, it takes a lot of pressure off of the need for like Moncada and Kopech to win like awards. Yeah. Like if Moncada is a top five second baseman rather than being like an MVP candidate, that's okay if like Basabe is also like a top 10 center fielder or top 15 center fielder sort of thing.
Well, as long as he makes it and is like a contributing major leaguer past like fourth outfielder, if he's just kind of the guy that you can run out there and be like, yeah, we don't really have to worry.
You don't have to play Adam Engel because you have Basabe instead.
You've got a guy who actually is going to give you, even if it's only 1 to 2 wins above replacement, that's still 1 to 2 wins above replacement.
Yeah, I mean, he's repeating A-ball. He's walked more than he struck out this year. He's hitting 385 with power. So far, so good. Anyway, I think that's about what I have for the moment. I don't know if you had any closing thoughts. Any animal PSAs before we go?
You know, just spay and neuter your pets. Keep them up to date on vaccines, microchips, all that good stuff.
Should you feed them people food?
No, you absolutely should not. Pancreatitis is expensive.
Is that the only downside?
I mean, that's always my go-to. People don't listen if you're just like, yeah, this is bad. Like, it's going to hurt your animal. They don't care. But if you're like, hey, it's really expensive to treat, then that's when they start listening.
Oh, God. Well, on that note, I guess... my thoughts are get well soon, Danny Farquhar, because by all accounts, he's a lovely human being, and that's terrifying. You know, obvious thing to say, but I definitely want to express the sentiment because it's not the joke is not joke, but the cliche is thoughts and prayers. But like, I legitimately find myself thinking about him and hoping he's okay throughout the day. So, definitely want to get that out there. And here's to Jose Abreu getting MVP votes.
Yeah,
both of those things.
Well, Mark, it's been a pleasure.
Always is. Thanks for having me again, Nick.
My best to Dante and Rebecca, and Maya.
Oh, I was about to say, oof. Poor Maya.
All right, later.
See you.